So look at him. Don't look at the camera. If you look at the camera, the viewers think you're staring into their soul.
Okay, so would you like the chair faced this way or this way?
That's a good point. Let's make the chair face that way so that it's more natural.
I'm trying to get closer to it, but all these wires and tables in the way, you know.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
So, I guess first things first. Anytime you feel like, oh shoot, I screwed that up, let me hip and hop that one more time. Just say, yo, hold up. Boom, boom, ready to go. And
okay.
Do it again.
Sure.
I'm not mic'd, so
okay.
If I ask you a question and you're like, huh, and then you say something like, cheeseburgers, and no one knows where that comes from, you have to be like, what would I eat if I was on the moon?
Gotcha.
Cheeseburgers.
Right.
That makes a lot more sense for people. And yeah, that's pretty much the two things that you should keep in mind.
Okay.
So where are we at and what's your name?
I'm Jay Silver. You are sitting in the Cube, also known as the Lego Learning Lab in the Lifelong Kindergarten at Media Lab, MIT, Boston, Earth, Galaxy, Ecosystem, Inside Your Heart.
That is, and there's a pig sneezing into it.
Yeah. There is a pig sneezing into it. See, that's the repetition that you wanted, right? You're not mic'd.
That's the awesome Venn diagram of the Media Lab.
Right. Heart is the biggest.
Yeah. The pig is outside there. Standing
maybe.
On top of turtles, standing on top of elephants.
Oh, yes. Yertle the turtle.
The great sneeze.
The great sneeze. You guys, does anybody know about the pig and the heart sneezing?
No.
Oh, okay. We'll look it up.
No, I don't know about the pig and the heart sneezing.
So, I guess, let me think, what were we talking about? I think the interesting thing that we were talking about is India hacks.
Okay.
Like, you care to explain what you mean by India hacks?
So when you talk about India and hacking, the whole country is just full of hackers, but they don't think of themselves that way. If you're riding in a rickshaw and the guy wants his left turn signal to go on, then he's rigged something up and he knows how to fix it when it breaks. And when you go to the market, the electronics market, it's this big ad hoc sequence of like dust is flying in the air and like it's hot and you can't quite, you know, tell people you want a resistor because they don't quite speak English. You have to say, I want the resistor. And you have to ask someone where to go and you get what you need and everyone knows how to make everything. And if you don't, they know someone who does. And they don't depend on the market for solutions.
So, I guess, where do you see the... Well, let's make a relationship between that and perhaps the hillbilly attitude that we were talking about yesterday. Is it a need-based thing that people come, like, that, I guess, people start coming up with these alternative solutions?
Well, so if you look at what you're calling, like, the hillbilly situation, maybe, like, in the South or out in the country in the United States, or just like all kinds of cultures that haven't been industrialized or you know, haven't been what you might call modernized in some sense of what we might mean by modern, then, and if you relate that to what's happening in all over, you know, and in and around India, what you've got is a situation where people aren't modern in a certain sense, and Illich would say they don't have modernized poverty. And what he would mean by that is that people can look to themselves and look to their own environment to find solutions for things. They can depend on themselves. They can look and they might not know how things work, but they can look to see how things work. They trust their own minds. They trust their own hands. They don't see everything as a black box. They're able to inquire into their environment.
So that's in perhaps like non-modern societies. Why do you think a similar trend is happening in these urban areas in America where these hackerspaces are beginning to form?
That's hard. I think what you're seeing is people feeling like they're not in touch with what's going on. And a lot of these hackerspaces, I mean, there's no one type of person that makes them up, but a lot of them are people with electronics backgrounds or people who are autodidacts with electronics. A lot of young people, a lot of male, I would dare say a lot of white. And what you're getting is people who are feeling like, oh my God, like I don't want to go into the traditional big path. I don't want to get on the interstate. I kind of want to stay on some side roads. I don't mind knowing how to get on the interstate, but I want to stay on some back roads and figure out my life a little bit. I feel like I'm detached from how things work. I want to know how things work. There's a lot to say about it.
Yeah. So let's. I'm gonna go through and try to come full circle. Let's think. So I guess I'd like to figure out a little bit about where you come from in terms of how you relate to everything that's going on and what brought you to where you are right now.
So you want a 1-minute biography?
Yeah.
Okay, so my 1-minute bio is I was raised by hippies and midwives. I took the big path, went through engineering school, came out the other side. I had accomplished all my dreams. Oh my God, this is just where I want to be, but I'm not happy. Why not? I took time off to figure it out. I took care of my sick dad. I took a yoga teacher's training. I met the love of my life. I surfed, I danced, and then I came to MIT because I already had an NSF fellowship lined up. When I got here, once again, I found it wasn't what I wanted. So I had to jump ship. I was going to drop out. I moved over to the media lab and carved out my own little world, a little bubble for myself.
And what kind of things in the media lab supported the bubble that you were forming? Like, why do you feel the media lab is a good home for you right now?
So media lab is a complicated place. And one thing that's interesting about it is everyone is expected to work on their passions. So there's even this book published, I think it's called Velocity, and just a little pamphlet where every professor was asked, well, like, what are you passionate about? Why do you love what you do? And not a lot of places publish little pamphlets like that. And you read it and you find out their group is basically named what they're passionate about. And so that's one example of that. There's a lot of other things going on. So there's like an umbrella funding structure at Media Lab, which means at least theoretically, there's no like directed funding. You fund the Media Lab, and Media Lab does lots of interesting stuff that they care about. And then as a sponsor, you come and get kind of like either IP or ideas or social interactions. At least that's the model and the way it's supposed to be set up.
Cool. Well then, let's try to figure out where the Media Lab comes from. What do you think is like the background of this passion-based attitude for learning?
In terms of passion-based attitude for learning, probably the Media Lab has its roots from there with Seymour Papert. Seymour Papert helped to found the lab. Seymour Papert believes in something called constructionism. And constructionism is basically the idea that you learn by building, and you learn by building in a context of a project that you're personally connected to, personally passionate about. So you can't just build, and you can't just be passionate, but you have to kind of make things and be passionate at the same time. And more or less, that's constructionism.
I'm going to ask you just to rephrase or reiterate the constructionism, like,
yeah,
because I think pretty much that is how a lot of the hackerspaces that we go define themselves.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so there are a lot of hackerspaces that use this idea of constructionism, and Media Lab is founded on, at least from Seymour Papert's roots, is founded on constructionism. And constructionism, although he never defines it, I would say is the basic idea that you learn by building and trying things in the real world and in the context of something you're passionate about. So a project that you're you find personally meaningful.
Yeah, and so like I tell the story often, but really, working on something that you're passionate about or something that you take as a project of your own increases your learning speed substantially. It's really amazing. They did this study where they followed people studying music, and for 5 years they followed these kids, and the one question on the whole sheet that related to a 40x battery,
yeah,
that related to a 40x increase in learning speed, mm-hmm, was the answer to how long do you see yourself playing this instrument?
Mm-hmm.
The people that said all my life, mm-hmm, compared to people that said 1 year,
mm-hmm,
40x.
Yeah.
Not percent.
Yeah.
40x.
Yeah, orders of magnitude. That's the basic secret.
It's, yeah.
This is what happens. And it's not always speed either. Although, I mean, I think it amounts to speed a lot of the times. But if you're passionate about something, and you follow your passions, I know you're not recording.
Yeah,
I can stop if you want.
You can stop and then you can reiterate. Sometimes it helps
can you.
You
can you actually just pull this up right
here? Yeah, great. When you follow your passions, you might not even necessarily keep studying that one thing. You might even switch courses, but you're never going to be like spinning your wheels. You're always going to be learning. You're always going to be caring and assimilating. And that's actually, that grows out of Piaget's constructivism, where he just said like, oh, don't tell people how the world is. You know, like don't dump knowledge into their head. Let them figure out how the world is and build their own model mentally. And out of that, Papert was like, oh, well, they should also build things in the physical world, follow their passions. That's constructivism carried out in action, constructionism.
So what is the property of passion that you think is important?
Passion means a lot of different things. And for some people, like, passion is affiliated with like immediate desires. So actually, in a lot of Eastern philosophies, they talk about being dispassionate. And that means not just kind of like fumbling around and following every whim that your mind throws to you. At the same time, what Americans usually mean when they say, you know, I'm passionate about something, or let's follow your passion, is something a little bit below the desires, below the immediate like, kind of like sensory wants and needs. But it's kind of like following your heart, finding your life's dharma, finding a path, doing what you think is right. It kind of has to do with conscience, the way Thoreau talks about conscience, has to do with being the change, the way Gandhi talks about being the change. Passion is living your life with every cell of your body.
Cool. So actually, this is something that I've been seeing a lot in these places where you're saying that, oh, passion is, in Eastern cultures, like following your initial whims, right? And it seems perhaps that the people that have this do-it-now attitude mm-hmm. that I actually value. Mm-hmm. I really like the idea of like, oh my God, if you have an idea, do it now. Mm-hmm. That there's no thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you get around that when you're trying to mix between doing things that you really care about and maybe jumping the gun?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot going on in what you're talking about there. So you're talking about, no, seriously, like there's so many things that come to mind. So you're talking about basically in these hacker spaces, people have kind of like a do it now attitude. Yeah, I just got an idea, let's build it. And that's something I think comes into like what I call like a maker way of looking at the world. You could call it hacker, you can call it maker. Part of that is like, let's iterate while it's hot. Like let's do the next iteration while I still care about it. If I come up with an idea and I tell you about it, you know, next week and I'm not as excited about it anymore, maybe it's not even that good of an idea. That's the thing. You come up with an idea, maybe it's not that good, but you're excited about it. And so you do it and you take action. And in the action taking process, new things start popping out and you follow those too. That's called serendipity. And that's called like keeping an open mind to things that can come up. And it's not a top-down structure. It's totally decentralized. And this is what is good about this kind of like jumping the gun. Like, yeah, let's jump the gun. The problem comes maybe if you don't ever take time to reflect. So you want to move in and out of these different modalities. Like, let's step back and think. Okay, let's, oh my God, I got an idea. Let's dive in. Now let's eat, you know, let's take care of ourselves. Let's relax.
Pancakes.
Pancake time.
Okay. there's so much to talk to you about.
And everything we talked about so far, too, we talked about, like, this much of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we only have a few minutes, so let me think. Where do you think new ideas come from?
Which type of ideas? When you say, where do I think new ideas come from? Which type of ideas are you talking about? It shouldn't be yet. They're coming to meet her. Yeah, I've got at least 15 minutes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So as you can see, it'll just be a small meeting. I'll show them my stuff.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. We want to talk about your stuff. Well, what I kind of want to talk about is more along the lines of what we were talking about earlier.
You know, you're looking for the philosophy, right?
Yeah, because lots of people do without thinking about, like, oh my God, I'm part of a bigger picture here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the bigger picture that, like, why do you think all these hackerspaces are popping up right now?
Okay, so I think that all these hackerspaces are popping up right now because we live in a time where it is prescribed what a certain object means. So let me take a step back in history a little bit. It used to be that we lived in nature, and it looked a little different than now. And when you saw something laying on the ground, you didn't say, oh, that came from the marketplace to solve a certain problem I have. No, you're like, no, that's one of my tools in my huge toolkit called nature. And in a day where most things we have around us come from the market and we have a kind of modern nature around us, kind of urban, man-made, some wilderness all mixed together, every single thing that comes to us, look, I already know the purpose of this, okay? I know what this is for. This, I already know the purpose. So I think in these hacker spaces, what they're saying is, these aren't for seeing, these are, let's look at them and let's see what they are. Oh, there's some lenses, there's some plastic, how else can we use this? And they're looking at objects and coming with a beginner's mind, coming with like an empty slate and saying, what is this? And they're, in that process, they're learning to see the tools around them as kind of like for all of their unlimited possibilities. They're learning to see whatever it is that they've got, not as what it was intended for, but what it really could be made into. And through that process, they learn to see themselves and their friends that way, kind of as unlimited, kind of not prescribed, not boxed in by a market, not boxed in by capitalism, not schooled, kind of none of these things, but really trying to see themselves for what they are. They're cutting through the illusory kind of matrix of the world by trying to see objects for what they really are and trying to use them any way they can think of. Is that the kind of thing you were going for?
We were talking about these things a little bit earlier.
Okay.
And, do you remember the communities? What are they called? The
intentional.
Intentional communities. Yes. How do you see the connection between them, and what is the cultural atmosphere that's breeding these places?
Yeah. So intentional communities have a long history. I just I spent a month a few years ago driving around the country visiting intentional communities. And I visited Twin Oaks. There is no mother of intentional communities, but they publish IC.org, and they're founded based on Walden 2, written by B.F. Skinner, which is like a game plan for intentional communities. And it's this really beautiful place, and there's lots of them. They all have their own plan, but what they all have in common is the people living there have a specific reason for living there. What they have an intention, and it's all in common. They're not living there to shelter themselves. They're living there because of ideals, because of dreams, because of what we talked about before, as passion, or any of these things. And what you see happening in hackerspaces is people coming together saying, look, we want to redesign our world. We don't want to accept our world the way it is. Everyone who kind of comes there agrees on that principle or some other principle that means something like it. There's no creed. Although probably individual hackerspaces have creeds. There's not any one creed. And so people are coming there to form together with other people with the same intention. That is the history of humanity until kind of the suburb phase of modern industrial culture. People are coming for that, and they are an intentional community. In fact, you'll probably find hackerspaces on IC.org.
Yeah, we should look that up and see. Oh yeah, Sugar Shack is definitely on IC.org and on hackerspaces.org.
Right. And I'm sure there's some intentional community on hackerspaces.org. They may just have a hackers area in their IC or whatever it is.
Let's talk about the purpose of making things. Why are they getting together to make things?
I guess for everyone it's probably a different motivation. So there's this common bond of people coming together. They all want to take things apart, see what's inside, make a new world, create a new reality for themselves. But I think it depends on your person what their motivation is. Some people are just excited. They see something exciting, they want to join in because they see basically a parade marching by. Some people have a genuine interest in changing the world for the better. I think in the best case, people are designing in these hackerspaces for humans first, not designing for profit, almost never in hackerspaces. I guess there's times when they are, it depends on the space. But you'll see people designing for humans first in these hackerspaces. You'll see people designing for what they believe to be the right way the world should work. You'll see people talking with their hands on things, there's materials in their hands, they're having a discussion, they're trying something, they're going back, discussing again. You'll see people put things out right away, whether it's to the hackerspace or to the nearby community or online to some kind of a web community. They iterate while it's hot. They put their ideas out, they get feedback, it's all open source, people share their ideas, and they see what resonates too. So they might make 10 things and only one resonates. Well, you don't spend 10 years making something and put it out. That's what companies do. You make something, you give it to the world. Does it resonate? If it does, spend more energy on it because you get energy back, and it's kind of a give and take. So you see that happening in the best case, I think, at these spaces. But also, I think people just want to learn and just want to try stuff, so it just depends who's coming.
Cool.
Do you want shorter answers?
If you want to shorten that up, that would be great.
Right.
Like, you kind of like went on a path and discovered what you wanted to say. And
that's
said.
True, yeah.
Do you want to say what you said?
I think there's different kinds of people that come to hackerspaces. Some that get caught up in the excitement, some that really have this idea of how to create the world and change the world for the better. And each person brings their own thing.
Cool. Let's talk about what you make. What do you make? So
there's different ways of coining it. My group is called the Lifelong Kindergarten. And they try to make creative learning toys for creative learning experiences. And they kind of have this idea in mind, oh, there's like a kindergarten, and kindergarten was made as an environment, not where knowledge is dumped into your head, but where you build your ideas, try them out in the real world. How can we make that a lifelong exploration? How can me and you, grandmas and, you know, Boy Scouts, people in and out of school, have the right tools to learn creatively? So my group works on that. I'd say I work on something related. The last paper I wrote was called Gifts for Intertwining with Modern Nature. So if I break that down a little, the stuff I work on is all about seeing the objects in your world without already knowing what they are. And so I make all kinds of tools for practicing that.
So just a concrete example.
A concrete example is... here's a concrete example. This is a Dradio circuit. It comes in kit or a pre-manufactured form factor, and it squeaks when the battery's in. And this is for seeing objects not as you think they are, but for repurposing them, for appropriating them. Let's just go up to the buzzer.
Oh, is that time?
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, we can
see, are you in your own movie ever or no?
Sometimes.
Well, this is best demonstrated with multiple people.
Yeah. How far away do we have to be? Let's
not that far. Yeah, I don't know. That's up to you guys. Did you want to see this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, so, and depending on what we want to do, we'll need different things. But also, you can grab stock footage.
Yeah.
So it's up to you.
I kind of want to talk about Adafruit too.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
So, what's your relationship with Adafruit? And first of all, what's going to happen when you guys connect hands right now?
I mean, there's no really telling. We have to try it and see. And then basically, I start encapsulating this in different form factors. I mean, we just explored our bodies, right? Like, well, okay, our bodies aren't for making circuits or music, right? But actually, maybe they are. We don't know what they're for. We have to uncover all of the possible meanings of life, right? They're not given. One way to encapsulate that circuit is in a form factor like a paintbrush. Do you want to see that demonstrated or move on?
Sure.
Or?
Well, actually, I'd like to talk about what you think the value behind something like this is. Like, you started talking about experimenting with your world, or your world is like a classroom.
Okay. So the value of, where should we go?
It depends on how the camera's focused. Do you want to sit down again?
Yeah, whatever your format, whatever works best for your format. So my hope is that circuits like this, you don't look at them. Just like, they're not useful. When you get this in your hands, let's say it's Christmas, you get one of these. Yeah.
We don't know what it is yet.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to say, when you have a circuit like a Dradio,
right,
in your hand.
Yep. Yeah. So when you have like a kit like Dradio or a circuit like Dradio in your hands, it's not useful for anything. It doesn't do anything. You connect it to all the things that are in your life, to your body, to your cat, to a banana, and you make a piano out of your banana, to the kitchen sink, and you've got a theremin with the water flowing out of the kitchen sink. You uncover all the possible meanings of the world that you live in. And like Hippocrates says, like the environment, your health is your health in your body and the health of your immediate environment. Well, like yourself extends beyond your skin too, to your immediate environment. And you don't really know yourself if you don't know all the meanings of things. So a circuit like Dradio points away from itself. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying it has like clicks.
Yeah. It's asking what's around you. It's like a magnifying glass. You can have a magnifying glass and you can study it all day long, but what's a magnifying glass for? It's not for itself. It's for looking at the flowers, for looking at your own skin. It's a tool for inquiry. So I view this as a tool for both inquiry and expression. So you inquire into your environment. What conducts electricity? What makes a good piano? And once you figure that out, you create it, and then you express yourself. So it's like a magnifying glass. It doesn't point to itself. I mean, this is no fun. We need the environment. We need to mix it with the environment. And that comes back to that thing I was talking to you about before. When we used to live in nature and we saw a stick on the ground, we didn't think, oh, that stick was sent to me for a certain reason. And I think we can learn to see our environment that way a little at a time by practicing. Oh, yeah, sink. That's not just for washing my hands. What could it be for? Anything.
I think that's definitely one of the attitudes that we, like, people proclaim and we find at hackerspaces, is that the whole, they don't view the world as it is. They view it as a classroom. Like, oh, my God, it's modular in nature. I can take this apple and I can cut a hole in it and make it like a temporary ball bearing for this fruit cart, right? And I think, yeah, similar to the way that you build stuff to explore the world, I think hackerspaces view the world as a classroom. And I'm wondering if you think that's an attitude that you yourself find in places like this.
In places like...
Like hackerspaces. Do you think that that's going on?
I think they're trying to, yeah. I think hackerspaces are seeing the world as a classroom. And I wouldn't say it that way. And the reason is because classrooms have so much wrapped up in them. It's a big suitcase of a word. It has a long history. There's a lot of baggage. And I mean, maybe the word learning is less loaded, but the world as a place to learn is a beautiful concept. And I think hackerspaces try to embody that. They try to say, we can live without institutional boundaries. The world is your place for learning. You know, the community you can apprentice the community, you can apprentice a book, you can learn without any kind of schooling structure.
That's interesting that you say that kind of stuff, especially since you're doing similar things in a learning institution.
Yeah.
How does that fit?
I think it's ironic, I think it's a catch-22, but I think Media Lab has that inherently built into it, and also I think I defy some of the rules of Media Lab in some way, and the rules are there to break to a certain degree. So I guess it's funny that I say, well, look, we have to let go of the idea of classrooms, but here I am going to school. I'm in grad school. Well, okay, so the classes are atelier style, project-based. You know, you come into the class, the teacher, who's really more like a facilitator, says, like, okay, let's have a discussion, and now let's try to build some stuff, and everyone come back and we'll talk about it. That's a typical class. So the classroom kind of extends out into the lab space and into the world.
Let's talk about the facilitator for a bit.
Okay.
Let's pretend that you're studying a hackerspace.
Yeah.
How would a facilitating attitude be a part of the hackerspace that you're studying?
Right. Well, this is going to be different for each person, but if you're starting a hackerspace and you're trying to think what your role is, if I tried to think what my role was, if I was starting a hackerspace, I would think, I am there to make an interesting enough environment, make a sort of a playground where the people who come and the objects that are going to come out of it can kind of grow out of the ground. It's more of an ecosystem. I'm more of a farmer, or maybe not even a farmer. Maybe I'm a permaculturalist. And I am just creating this kind of diverse environment where little things can crop up, and sometimes things I didn't expect, and sometimes even things I don't want, and I'm kind of going around, kind of ushering things around and trying to give and take with the environment, kind of the way a permaculturalist, or if you want, a farmer, kind of gives water but doesn't make the plant grow. The plant grows. The farmer facilitates.
You have to be willing to accept things that you don't really want sometimes growing out of a place like this.
That's interesting. I think if you are somehow in an authority position at a hackerspace, you do have to accept things you don't want coming out of it. And sometimes it's a matter of your wants versus the community and the world's wants. So if it's really like, oh, I don't want this, I'm the facilitator, I don't want this, well, maybe it's good to let it happen. If you're thinking, this is terrible for all the other people in the community, this is gonna make a lot of people not be able to learn, it's gonna shut the place down, you know, then maybe it is the right time for you to step in.
It's interesting that we're talking at the Media Lab, because some of the people's concerns is that, oh, you know, you set up this environment, you have people playing, that's really good and well, but you're gonna get people making things that are silly, things that are not useful, but you have this environment at the Media Lab where people have made things that are useful and that are actually out and in the real world doing really well. Do you think that, why is there value in play?
Okay.
Is it gonna develop to anything more than just a toy?
Gotcha.
We've had people argue that.
Yep. So you're asking basically like, so what about like this idea that at Media Lab or at Hackerspaces, people might make things that aren't useful or utilitous, or people might, you know, make stuff that don't end up being in the real world. Or maybe sometimes at Media Lab, people make stuff that, you know, that does end up in the real world. So what's the use of kind of play? What's the use of making something that, you know, isn't utilitous or something like that? And there's a philosopher who said that, you know, the machines we make for us are slaves for us, and someday we'll have enough of them, and they'll replace all the real slaves in the world. And at that time, there were slaves. And when I hear that, I think to myself, not everything has to serve us. Not everything we make it has a utilitous function, and is some kind of a. Not everything we make is there to accomplish some kind of a tangible product. Kind of losing the train, but it's like the point is that when something is only there to serve you, then you don't develop kind of a dialectic dialogue relationship with it. There are things that play third-party roles all the time. Hey, I made this. It's not useful for anything. Oh my God, I just had this great idea because I was in flow playing, and this great idea led to something, the most useful thing ever. Or sometimes it doesn't lead to that. But the process is kind of the product. If you go in there and think, how can I make something useful? How can I make something useful? Then the product is this futile, kind of stressed out result. If you go in there and say, what's beautiful? I'm a musician. I'm a jazz musician, and I'm improvising with my soldering iron. And let's see what comes out of this. And if it's a mistake, I'll accept that and move forward with it. What comes out, if the process really is the product, is this kind of flowing kind of this product that really is beautiful and that can inspire people. You don't get inspired by utility.
So, how do you facilitate the attitude for making as many mistakes as possible?
Oh, that's such a good question. How do you facilitate the process of making as many mistakes as possible? I'm pretty sure I made this up. I don't know if I heard it from someone. Dead ends are part of the map. And if you're just trying to figure out the shortest line from point A to point B, then you have no idea what the landscape's looking like. And you're not enjoying the process. So dead ends are part of the map. That's a big thing. And how do you make that happen then, if that's true? Well, I make videos that some people would call tutorials. I call them facilitorials. And in the videos, I make mistakes. They're planned, and I show by example, by modeling, that mistakes can be made. You don't always have to plan to model mistakes. You just have to not prepare everything, not basically put up a facade, not kind of like, oh yes, everything works when I do it because I'm good at it or something like that. When you put out tutorials, when you teach people something, you just kind of naturally show them what you would really do. Oh, here's how I actually work. Oh, I made a mistake. Let me see why. So you kind of model this kind of thing. Like, how do you set up a space where people know they can make mistakes? Have people in that space making mistakes.
Does that happen at the Media Lab?
I think it does. And it depends which professor you're with. You know, and there's little bubbles everywhere. There's the culture over here in the Media Lab. There's the culture upstairs. There's a professor who says, yeah, try stuff, make some mistakes. And there's a professors who get their hands dirty and make mistakes themselves. So I think it does happen, but you get a little of everything everywhere. So if you're at a hackerspace, if you're at the Media Lab, if you're in a school, you have free thinkers, you have people who want to tell you how it is. You have a little of everything everywhere.
So because we know we have very little time, there's one question that I ask everywhere, because yep. I'm wondering, like, what's going on? Why are we all using this word at the same time? What do you think word hacker or hacker?
I think to hack is to look with an open mind. Hackers hook things up backwards. They recycle, they upcycle, they double cycle. You might not even know what double cycle means, but you'll find a meaning for it. People hook things up the wrong way. People try things out to see what happens. And half the times, nothing happens. But they're trying, and they're inquiring, and they're looking into basically an abyss that no one's ever explored. Every time you try something and don't know if it works, you're uncovering a mystery. So when people say hack, I think they mean that they're just coming with an open mind. They're coming with the beginner's mind. They're leaving the cup half or more empty to see what can come in.
Cool.
Oh.
So, yeah, let's cut.
Is it time? How much more time? well, it's flexible. We're responding to. Yeah, and you guys are kind of the. No, but do you think like 3 more minutes? Because if so, I should set up. So I think how much time do you guys need to move that light? Okay, so let's set up now. I'll be ready in 3 minutes. Okay.
Battery to charge more, anyways.
Great. So let's debrief and.
Yeah.
Because you can get knocked into different modes and get repetitive, so let me know.
What are you thinking? How do you like where we're going?
Interviews are always harder than they seem like they're going to be. But, you have to have bright lights, and we can't be walking around.